And it's Steve Tasker who has been all over the field.
Kind of unique. He was kind of a dual role player for you.
Steve.
A balloon.
Steve. A blimp. We're not even in the stratosphere of normalcy.
All right, we are queued up on a Monday. Chris Brown, along with Thad Brown, sports director, WROC-TV in Ra-Cha-Cha, joining me again here on Monday. Filling in for Steve Tasker, who will be back tomorrow. And funny thing happened this weekend. It's called the Pro Bowl, Thad. At least that's what it's still called in name. I think it's drifting further and further away from real football. I'm almost inclined to watch their dodgeball event that they had through the course of the week before I got to admit, I didn't watch a second of the game. I saw only highlights. Did not watch a second of the game. Did not carve out any niche of time this weekend to make sure I caught it. I know you're a football junkie. You probably watched some of it, but I just didn't do it.
Don't imply that I had interest in watching that because I was a football junkie. If I wanted to watch football, I would watch anything but the Pro Bowl. I did watch some of it, to be totally honest, simply because I was on this show and figured we'd probably talk about it, so yeah. I should have some awareness of what it was. But, yeah, I mean, look, it's as bad as you said. I mean, it's just from the moment that the first interception for a touchdown happens, I think this is going to be it right here, where it became clear that no one was going to make an effort to tackle or hit anyone. It was the kind of thing that you didn't need to watch as a football fan. See that? I mean, do you see a lot of the form tackling right there? I mean, great, yeah. It's offensive linemen allegedly making tackles. Look, the game has been like this for a while, and I know that there's going to be a lot of, you know, huffing and puffing today about how it's not real football and needs to be, you know, totally changed and revamped. And yet later on today, we're going to find out what the ratings are for this game, and I'm sure that they will, I don't know, double, triple, whatever else was on during that time period or during that afternoon on Sunday, even compared to what was a pretty interesting golf tournament, which is where my viewing pleasure went, you know, not long after I decided this game was not worth my time. So, you know, I mean, you can tell me how terrible it is, and I'll agree with you, but it made a whole lot of money, and it did really good ratings. And, you know, from my eyes, it seemed like the players had a fairly good time at it. So, you know, yeah, it's not great, but someone tell me why this thing is so terrible. You know, I mean, if you want to see, you know, knock down, drag out week 17, you know, win or go home football, well, that happened in week 17. This is not that.
Right. I think you have to go in with the right expectations, maybe more than anything else. I didn't know when, and because I probably haven't paid enough attention to this game over the last several years, I didn't know when tackling became like optional. You know,
yeah, that was kind of new to me too, Chris. I'll agree. The whole idea of we're going to blow the whistle on literally almost two hand touch.
Yeah. The Mac Jones play comes to mind on that. Yeah. Where he starts running.
Any play comes to mind on that, really. I mean, it was the whole game.
So
first play I saw, Chris, was like a 2 yard out from Mahomes, one of the AFC receivers. And it's a 2 yard out. And then the linebacker comes up and just grabs him, and whoo, whistle blows, play over.
Yeah.
And, you know, I wasn't expecting, you know, Sean Taylor, Brian Mormon level contact, but, you know, even that kind of raised an eyebrow. So, I mean, again, look, if people want to talk about how to fix it, you know, the game is not a real game, right? So why not lean into that? Why not make this like the Harlem Globetrotters of the NFL? Let's let the guys go out and put a mic on Stephon Diggs. He can talk trash to his brother while he's breaking him down. Or even maybe if you want, bring in a football team that would be the football version of the Washington Generals. Find some junior college team can go out there and just be the dummies for the week. And Stephon Diggs like goes into his triple break, you know, in, out. Some guy like falls over because his ankles are in 16 different directions. I mean, really, if we're gonna fix this, I think leaning into the idea that it's not a real game, let's have total fun with it, is about the only thing I got for you.
Yeah, and you're right. It does make money, and I think even Pro Football Talk wrote a story about this, basically saying as long as it keeps making money and is profitable, they'll keep it as it currently exists because enough people are into it where they're coming out ahead. They're finishing in the black with respect to the accounting ledger, and you know, in the grand scheme of things, that's probably all that matters. And it'll probably continue as it currently exists. We'll talk more about the Pro Bowl and what its future should look like here soon. One of the participants in the Pro Bowl, Thad, was placed under arrest just hours after the game. Saints running back Alvin Kamara was arrested on charges of battery after he allegedly beat the pulp out of some guy who had to be hospitalized after an altercation Saturday night. The day before the game in a Las Vegas nightclub, investigation still ongoing. But the reason this has more interest, especially to Bills fans who are constantly cruising around on social media, is everybody knows that the Saints are $74 million over the cap. And logic says they're going to have to throw some people overboard via trade here in the not-too-distant future, because with all the fiery hoops they jumped through last year just to get under the cap, I mean, that was like fiscal gymnastics personified. It's even a heavier lift this year, and I don't see how they get around it short of trading a couple of high-priced players, and Kamara would certainly fit that bill. Still a young player, arguably in the prime of his career, 5 years in the league, five Pro Bowls, and a very versatile player out of the backfield. He would be very attractive to a lot of teams. Some Bills fans I've seen on social media even floated the idea, hey, if Kamara's available, the Bills should, you know, get in on that. And I get why they would feel that way. This kind of throws a wet blanket on the whole thing. I'm not saying it's like going to keep the market down on Kamara. He's an unbelievable player, and we've seen teams look the other way on this kind of stuff before. And who knows? Maybe the charges get dropped and it's a moot point in a month from now. But it kind of throws a wet blanket on that prospect a little bit.
You know, the one thing I thought about this is, did they wait until after the game to arrest him? I mean, yeah. I didn't look into it that far. But, I mean, so this happened Saturday night. They let him play the game at 3 in the afternoon, and the cops come in the locker room and
it's not clear if he got escorted out of the locker room. The closest description I could get from the reports coming out of there were hours after the game was over. So my guess is they either met him leaving the stadium, I don't know, at his hotel room, somewhere. But it doesn't sound like he was escorted out of the locker room with a squad car down to the station. I don't know.
But either way, you know, the guy was in the hospital Saturday evening. You know, ostensibly he identified, oh, yeah, it was Alvin Kamara. Probably before the game happened, they let him play in the game. I mean, look, there's a lot more that needs to come out with this. But back to your original point about Kamara, obviously a guy like that in the Bills offense would be nasty. I mean, it would be, you know, about the ideal situation you could have for a running back. I mean, look, the guy would be great in any offense. It's Alvin bleeping Kamara, for God's sake. But the thing with Kamara in this, you know, what to see where it goes. You know, I mean, to try and assess, you know, what kind of impact we might have of an arrest less than 24 hours after it happens. Like you said, you know, the way these things go, the charges could be dropped in a couple of weeks. And, you know, who knows how it's going to go? So wait and see. I would say on its face, this is probably not something that's going to dissuade a team that is dialed in on trading for Kamara if they want to.
Right. Moving on to a more Bills-related topic, the Bills look like they're going to continue to get poached by the Giants as they build up their front office, coaching staff, and roster. According to NFL Network's Mike Garafolo, quarterback Davis Webb is at the Giants facility today for a physical. Reports are he could sign with them as early as today. And for Bills fans wondering, what the heck, why can he go there? Why is he a free agent? It's because his practice squad contract expired. And so he becomes a free agent ostensibly in January rather than in mid-March. And I don't think we have to connect the dots here for the listening audience. They kind of know the history here. And I don't know. I know that Davis Webb was certainly an asset for Josh in the quarterback room. And I saw that you actually tweeted this last night at some point. The quarterback room, assuming Trubisky's leaving too in free agency, if he can find a starting job somewhere, quarterback room's empty now.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be a different group for Josh Allen. Look, as much as Davis Webb brought to the team, and Brian Daboll, among all the coaches, I mean, everybody said this, but I thought Brian Daboll was the one that kind of discussed it at length the most. You know, Davis Webb was one of the best practice players you can have. The number of things that he did behind the scenes were more than any of those coaches could count. And you could see why, you know, Brian Daboll might want to, you know, pony up some money, maybe even offer an active roster spot for Davis Webb. You know, I wonder if he's dangling, you'll be the backup quarterback to Daniel Jones to get him down there. So there's certainly attractiveness for him, for Webb, or potentially for Daboll to bring Webb in. The thing is about Josh, he's past the point now where I think you need to worry about him having good influences around him. This is not a guy that any longer needs experienced backup quarterback X or coordinator who's been about around the block. He's the guy that runs the offense in a lot of ways. Obviously, Ken Dorsey can be the coordinator, call the shots, all that stuff. But Josh Allen doesn't need that net anymore. He can work without it. So I don't think from the Bills' point of view in the quarterback room, this is a huge loss. The one thing I do want to say about the quarterback room, though, you think about what they had last year. You had a starter at the top of his game. You had arguably maybe the best backup in the NFL. In Davis Webb, you had the best practice squad or practice level quarterback in the NFL. I mean, that had to be the best quarterback room maybe in the history of football, outside of when Joe Montana and Steve Young played together. So to go from that to whatever the Bills put out there this year, and as long as Josh Allen is there, it'll still be fine. But, you know, some really, really good depth is probably walking out the door this year. And you know, will there be an effect? Who knows? I mean, how many games is Josh Allen going to play next year? But it was a really good situation to be in, and it'll be different this season.
Yeah, and, you know, you try to find a landing spot for someone like Trubisky, and, you know, Tampa needs a quarterback. We know that. And there are other teams. New Orleans needs a quarterback because Winston's a free agent, and he's coming off a major knee injury. So, yeah, the anticipation is that Trubisky will be somewhere else as well. I find it hard to believe he would be here. But then that leads to wondering, all right, well, who might be considered a viable candidate? And immediately, you know, Bills Mafia is off and running. Get Fitz in here as a backup quarterback at age 39.
As someone who has to talk to people on the team, and you, I think, would agree with this, Ryan Fitzpatrick on this team can happen as soon as possible.
Yeah, I don't mind it at all. Not to mention the fact that I think he can still play.
Yeah, I agree.
All that being said, you know, what's the likelihood of that? I guess we'll have to find out as we get closer and closer to free agency to see how things work.
Well, Chris, you know, the one thing about that is it might depend on, you know, what happens with Mitch. If Mitch Trubisky ends up with an opportunity to start, whether it be, you know, in San Francisco, it won't be there, but wherever it might be, Giants potentially, if they want to bring him to compete with Daniel Jones or somewhere else. If his landing spot is good, then I think it would improve the Bills' chances of landing a top backup quarterback. And end of the day, you know, Bills' backup quarterback might be the chair for whatever guy who wants to start, you know, loses out when the music stops and all the chairs are filled. Whoever is left standing might want to just go to Buffalo and follow what Trubisky did. So, you know, we talked about this last year when Trubisky signed. You know, the Bills could be in a position to land that guy on a regular basis, and I don't see why that has changed. You know, we'll see how it all shakes out.
Right. On the coaching front, the Dolphins are going to name San Francisco offensive coordinator Mike McDaniel as their new head coach. That kind of broke late on the weekend. He had been the 49ers coordinator for this past year, but it's been an NFL assistant for 16. And there were reports, Thad, that Miami's defensive staff was going to remain intact from what it was under Brian Flores for the most part, with Josh Boyer as defensive coordinator, with McDaniel coming in. But now there are reports out of South Florida that McDaniel's pursuing former Broncos head coach Vic Fangio to be his defensive coordinator. So we've got some conflicting reports there. Fangio, obviously, an accomplished defensive coach. So it'll be interesting to see if the Dolphins front office allows him to name his defensive staff rather than inherit one. I know that's an uncommon thing, but it did happen here when a first-time head coach by the name of Mike Mularkey got hired by the Bills and general manager Tom Donohoe, and he had to inherit Jerry Gray and the defensive staff.
It's not unheard of. You know, I think when the Jets were deciding between Adam Gase and Matt Rhule, one of the sticking points from Rhule's point of view is that Jets management wanted to dictate which offensive coordinator he took on. So it's not a brand new thing if it does happen. I think most coaches don't want any part of it, because when you're the head coach, you're supposed to pick your staff for obvious reasons. Yeah. I mean, you not only do you want a certain philosophy or scheme, but you got to work with these guys every day, you know, and if you're being forced to, you know, have a marriage with somebody you're not comfortable with, it's not going to be an ideal situation for anybody. You know, that one of the other things about this that was, you know, fascinating to me is that when Robert Saleh left San Francisco for the Jets, the story out of San Francisco was that Kyle Shanahan and Saleh sat down and kind of divvied up assistants. They, you know, Shanahan said, you can take Mike LaFleur to New York. I'm pretty sure it was McDaniel, among other guys. And now McDaniel has his own job in the same division, you know? So the Bills for the foreseeable future, their coaching opponents will be Bill Belichick and the 2020 San Francisco 49ers staff. You know, that'll be everybody they face in division every year. So, you know, we'll see. I mean, he did a really nice job, McDaniel did, with arguably one of the worst quarterbacks in the playoffs, nearly getting him to the Super Bowl. You know, making Deebo Samuel into Weapon X is a pretty unique piece of ingenuity. So, you know, this guy's got some chops, and you know, I'll be interested to see what he can do with Tua and what the Dolphins have. I mean, they have weapons. You know, Parker and Waddle and Gesicki are, you know, formidable guys when it comes to skill position-wise in the NFL.
Right, and what you just pointed out may have been his most attractive quality, the fact that he made Garoppolo a serviceable quarterback. He didn't by any means carry the load per se, but, you know, he made him effective enough to help them win football games. You have to believe the hope is at the very least he can do that and maybe even a little bit more with Tua, who physically, you know, lacks elite traits. You know, how can you devise a scheme that allows you to take advantage of the best of what he has to offer, which is getting the ball out in a quick timing rhythm type offense? And, you know, really his only elite trait is kind of what he has between his ears. So that'll be a meeting of the minds, the Yale grad Mike McDaniel with Tua. Going back, see, because we had Armando Salguero on last week on the show, and he hinted that the front office wants the new head coach to inherit the defensive staff. And, you know, as you pointed out, and this is 100% accurate, there is an inherent level of trust that a head coach has when he assembles his staff. I hired this guy, he's my guy, quote unquote, that kind of thing. And that will not be the case if they, you know, mandate, hey, McDaniel, you got to keep the defensive staff here. Armando portrayed it as the front office believes they're very close to reaching critical mass on the defensive side of the ball, and they don't want to upset the apple cart. And I would kind of argue, like, I mean, they improved in the second half of the year. They were a top 10 sack unit at the end of the season defensively, and they were a top 10 pass defense due to those corners. But, I mean, they were kind of middle of the pack everywhere else. So, I don't know, maybe they see something that the numbers are not bearing out for all of us. I think it's a risk, though. I mean, we saw how it went here. With Malarkey, the first year was fine and dandy. The defense, you know, ranked second in the league that year. They almost made the playoffs. But then in 2005, the thing completely fell apart. And the coaching offices, I mean, you could have drawn a Mason-Dixon line. It was so divided that second year. And the season turned up into a mess. They went 5-11 that year. And, you know, the thing got blown up. So there's some risk there because how are they going to handle it if it goes wrong early? You know, are guys going to close ranks and unite behind Mike McDaniel? Or are they going to turn on him and make it ugly real fast?
I think that's the danger of trying to do that kind of forced marriage thing. Because, you know, when you have adversity, when there is a situation where it doesn't look like things are going right, you know, in that spot, guys are more likely to protect number one and, you know, look out for themselves and not really worry as much about the team philosophy. I'm with you, too, on the defense. I mean, the Dolphins defense was better. It almost could not have gotten worse from what they were in the first half of the season. And they have good corners. And you know, Jalen Phillips, the rookie, had eight plus sacks, something like that. So, you know, there's some promise there in terms of an edge rusher. But I don't see a Dolphins defense that was so good that I need to, you know, really drive a wedge potentially between my coaching staff to keep that together. I mean, the players are largely the ones that engineer everything. You know, I mean, the NFL has always been a league that where coaching is very important, maybe more so than the other sports, but it's still a players league. And you have the same players on the field in general in Miami. I don't see any reason why you have to make sure that the defensive staff stays together to keep that like you said, middling squad going in the direction it is. I think if you're going to, you know, bring a head coach in, you want to give that guy the autonomy, you know, to hire his own staff. I mean, look, and that's part of it too. If you're as a head coach and you come in and you're being told you have to take on half your staff by the GM, how much respect does that give you in the coaches' meetings, in the meetings with the players, when you've already, you know, you're already a head coach that has significantly less influence than the other 31 guys in the league? You know, that there's a need to, you know, make that coach, give that coach an ability to be respected. And if it doesn't work out quick, you know, it's an easy reason for guys to, like I said, just, you know, worry about themselves.
I feel like the Dolphins are very much where the Bills were, you know, somewhere between 2004 and 2009. They were so desperate just to get back to the playoffs that they were playing the knee-jerk reaction game and just doing whatever might help the most in the immediate future instead of playing the long game. You've just hired a new head coach. In all likelihood, as NFL history has told us, first-year head coaches don't get to the playoffs. So play the long game there. You know, let McDaniel build it the way he wants to build it with his staff, you know, and then take it from there with the front office with Chris Greer and company. I just feel like they're always trying to knee-jerk themselves to get back into playoff, back into the postseason where they haven't been for several years now. Now, speaking of head coaching hirings, the Houston Texans have made a mockery of the head coaching hiring process after interviewing Brian Flores, who later sued the league, and then Josh McCown, whose only coaching experience is at the high school level where he coached his son's high school team. They finally interview an in-house candidate in Lovie Smith February 6th. The in-house guy is the last one to interview, and all of a sudden he has zoomed to the top of the list. I don't know about you, Thad, but this doesn't pass the smell test for me.
It doesn't pass a lot of tests for me. I mean, I can't imagine being a Texans fan right now. And this is a franchise that, 2 years ago, you know, had a 2-touchdown lead in the Chiefs in the first half of a playoff game on the road, you know, and now they're, you know, reduced to this. I think a part of it, too, is, you know, you wonder if there are enough legitimate head coaching candidates to go around. I mean, I know, look, the Texans are a mess and this whole thing is a disaster. But when you got Mike McDaniel being hired and having half of his staff dictated to him, when, you know, Josh McCown is even getting interviews as much as a farce as the Texans are, you know, I can't think of a young coach that I've really been impressed with the last couple of years, maybe short of a Brian Flores before all the fallout in Miami and everything that's been going on there. So I think this might be a part of it, but I don't know what's going on with the Texans. I mean, this is a franchise that, they were run by the chaplain, team chaplain, 2 years ago? Less than that?
Yeah, Jack
so
Easterby.
Maybe this is par for the course for them. You know, I mean, like I said, I can't imagine, you know, being a Texans fan. I don't know what's in the mind of those people, what's in the mind of Deshaun Watson right now. Obviously has his own issues. I can't think of a sports franchise anywhere that has deteriorated as fast and as precipitously as the Texans have over the last 24 months.
Yeah, it's I thought they had reached rock bottom. They found a layer or two beneath that. And it's not done because let me just say and be clear about this. I have nothing against Lovie Smith. The guy's an accomplished coach in this league. He's been a head coach at two different teams. As a matter of fact, if he does get the head coaching job, I think he will be the only black head coach to serve as head coach for three different NFL franchises in a career. I know Romeo Crennel technically did it as an interim for one before coaching two others. But still, if he is in fact hired as the head coach, as many people believe he will, now they're talking about Josh McCown possibly having a role on that staff so they can groom him, you know, for a future role as a head coach. I'm hearing those reports. If I'm Lovie Smith, I'm like, what? Now you want me to be the head coach, but now I'm going to be the next placeholder, just like David Culley was for a year? Like, what the hell is that?
And if you want to spin that further, you know, the conversation we had Thursday talking about the Flores lawsuit and, you know, in terms of the accusations of racism and minority hiring practices and stuff like that, the Texans have already been a team that's kind of in the crosshairs of being suspicious of their hiring practices and the way their organization is run. If you are going to hire back-to-back minority coaches, one essentially to have be a placeholder in David Culley and have zero chance to retain the job, and two, to outright be a placeholder so you can groom the white coach who's never, ever been a coach in the NFL to be the head coach. I mean, I can't imagine the PR people in the NFL headquarters are enjoying that idea at all. You know, and look, separate of that, it's terrible football practice, but also it just takes a bad situation in Houston, you know, held against an already very negatively viewed situation around the league, and you make it 18 times worse.
Yeah, it's downright cringeworthy. It really is. Like you said, what are the people in the NFL offices on Park Avenue doing? They're wincing right now. They're cringing as to what might be afoot down there in Houston. And then I saw that Raiders interim head coach Rich Bisaccia is going to be the new special teams coordinator for the Green Bay Packers. Good idea after they got bounced out of the playoffs due in large part to their failures on special teams against the Niners in the divisional playoff. And then Titans GM John Robinson, Thad, doubling down on his commitment to Ryan Tannehill, reiterating that Tannehill is their starting quarterback going forward. Something tells me his cap figure might be the only reason that's the case, because he's got a $28 million cap hit if they release him. We've seen stranger things happen. I mean, the Eagles took a bigger cap hit than that to move Wentz. So it's not out of the realm of possibility, but I think a lot of people in Tennessee are like, ooh, can we get Aaron Rodgers? Oh, what about Russell Wilson? Because we certainly don't like the way Ryan Tannehill looked when he threw three picks in the divisional playoff.
I've always kind of been a Tannehill fan slash defender slash apologist, I guess. Yeah, I've liked him even when he played for Miami. I thought he didn't get enough credit. I think, you know, we're watching him, you know, score on the ground. I think he's underrated with what he can do with his legs. Look, I'm not going to sit here and tell you he's a top 10 quarterback in the NFL, but this goes back to the old Doug Whaley conversation about quarterback purgatory. You know, if you get rid of Ryan Tannehill, who you're bringing in? Sure. If you want to get Rodgers or Russell Wilson, I mean, who wouldn't endorse that? But I think the Titans this year had one of the worst injury situations in the NFL. And we look at Mike Vrabel. People talk about Mike Vrabel as a coach of the year candidate because of that. Well, Ryan Tannehill, the quarterback, probably should get a little bit of a boost in his opinion because of all the – he played with A.J. Brown for three quarters of a season. Julio Jones was irrelevant. Derrick Henry missed half the season. They were still the number one seed in the NFL, and were it not for two deflected interceptions, you know, they would have made it at least the AFC Championship game. And since Cincinnati won that game, you know, you're not going to tell me Tennessee couldn't have won that game too. So I know I'm reaching a little bit, but look, I think Tannehill's fine. You're probably right. There's a cap figure there why John Robinson's going to say we love him. But also, you know, unless you're going to trade for one of these, you know, nomadic, incredibly talented quarterbacks, I don't see how you get better than Ryan Tannehill in Tennessee. And I don't think there's a whole lot of guys in the NFL that would make them better.
Right. I mean, that's really where it ends. That's the bottom line. You could do a lot worse than Ryan Tannehill. You know, just ask the Denver Broncos or, you know, the Carolina Panthers, and they'll be happy to tell you. So I think John Robinson's just taking the bird in the hand, two in the bush approach here. I know what I have right now. That doesn't mean I'm not going to be looking for better, but I'll stick by this guy now. And if the landscape changes, well, then, you know, I can cross that bridge when I get to it. So, I mean, what else is he really going to say at this point? So that's pretty much the look around the league, NFL news and notes. We are talking, though, about improving the Pro Bowl. How do we make this thing better, or at least more watchable? We understand a lot of people are watching it already, but if you have a suggestion, and I don't care, you could be as creative as you want to be. You want to have a dodgeball tournament instead? I'll sign up for it. I'd love to watch NFL players play dodgeball for 60 minutes. We saw some of it during the week with some of the stuff they were doing in terms of the recreational activities they were putting the players through. You could sign me up for that, but you let us know. What's the best way to make the NFL Pro Bowl more interesting? 803-0550, 1-888-550-2550, or you can hit us up on the tweet sheet at OneBillsLive. We will take a break here, but be back with your calls and your tweets next. Here on OneBillsLive, presented by Collider Health, it's Buffalo Bills Radio. We'll be right back. All right, welcome back to One Bills Live. Chris Brown, Thad Brown with you here on a Monday. And, boy, you always come across, we always talk, Steve and I always joke, how the internet is undefeated. There are people tracking stuff down or doing something hilarious. And there's an Arizona Cardinals beat reporter who just tweeted this out because it seemed strange to him, saying that Kyler Murray has apparently scrubbed all Arizona Cardinals references and photos from his Instagram account. Does it mean anything? Who the heck knows? But it certainly is strange. And the only reason that this is probably going to cause at least some Cardinals fans to shudder a little bit is because of the fact that Kyler Murray was drafted by the Oakland A's in baseball and is a pretty accomplished outfielder. And I remember this from about week 10 or 11 this season. He came to a post-game press conference with an Oakland A's hat on one time. And I'm thinking to myself, Kyler, what about optics here, bud? Like, I think it was after a loss, too. And I'm just thinking to myself, what are you doing? Like, you got drafted by that team in Major League Baseball. You swore your allegiance to the Cardinals, and now you're wearing this hat. And look, I'm probably making a mountain out of a molehill here, and in all instances, this probably means nothing. But it certainly raises – it's probably going to raise some eyebrows among the fan base in Arizona. Like, what's afoot here? It's probably nothing. I don't know why you'd want to play for anybody but Cliff Kingsbury, who was his college coach. I know they kind of faded each of the last 2 years, but it certainly is going to lead to some speculation down there in the desert.
Well, this is the last year coming up in 22 of his 4-year, you know, rookie deal. Obviously, there's the 5th-year option, which if the Cardinals haven't activated already, I'm sure they will. So it could, to me, be a contract ploy, a negotiation ploy. And look, this is – if I had $5 for every time a player scrubbed their – team's information and logo off their Instagram, I wouldn't have to sit here and talk to you for the afternoon. So this is not a brand new thing. And you're right. It probably is not going to turn out to be a big deal, but look, if it was the Bills and Josh Allen did this, you and I would be spending weeks talking about, you know, what it could mean, what's going right. to happen next. It'll be a thing for sure. You know, and it's not nothing, you know, that you don't have to do that. But my guess off the top of my head is that it's a contract issue / negotiation / ploy. And, you know, eventually everything will be worked out, because if you are going to extend him, you know, this is the year you would want to do it. You know, this is the off season where that discussion will probably get going. So, but hey, you know what, we're getting close to that part of the year in the NFL, right, where anything that is even borderline discussable becomes the most important thing ever.
Right.
You know, only one more game, and then we got 6 months of this. So everybody buckle in. It's just the beginning.
Right. And I would say, you know, okay, if it is a negotiating tactic in, you know, pursuit of a long-term deal to kind of bypass the fifth-year option, much the way, you know, Josh Allen did, you're probably waiting to see what Lamar Jackson gets, because the odds are he's the next guy that's going to get a deal. I, you know, despite Lamar Jackson's detractors, I do think that Baltimore is committed to him wholeheartedly and is ready to give him a giant, you know, second contract. And I would anticipate he's probably first on the list here. So while Kyler Murray might be doing that as a negotiating tactic, I don't know if he wants to rush into that right away, especially if you want to eventually get more than the guys last year got. A Lamar Jackson deal is only going to help you in that vein, as I see it. So, I don't know. I guess we'll see.
I think you're probably right there. Yeah. I think waiting for Lamar Jackson's deal first makes sense from Kyler's point of view. You know, Lamar's a former MVP. Kyler Murray's what played and didn't really play well in one playoff game. Lamar Jackson's, you know, one playoff game, has been to playoff games. So you would think his contract would be better. And if you're Kyler, you're probably better off waiting for him to sign. It doesn't mean, though, that if you're Kyler, and I would imagine his agent at some point has already opened, hey, you know, an initial negotiation, if we're going to sign long-term, I think we want to, you know, what would you offer? It's not out of the realm for the Cardinals to come back with something that's so low from Kyler's point of view that he's like, ah, you know, bleep it. I'm done with this team. I'm going to get rid of my Instagram. And like you said, let's get my baseball glove back on and see how that might work.
Yeah. It's something that I'm going to keep an eye on for sure, just to kind of see where it goes. He'll probably just say, oh, it's nothing. I was just sprucing up my Instagram page and wanted to try something different. We want to get to the tweet sheet, which is brought to you by Corrigan Moving Systems, the official equipment moving company of the Buffalo Bills. As we were asking you with our Twitter conversation today, what's the best way to make the NFL Pro Bowl more interesting? Jeremy leads us off and says, although not the apex of the season, it's a week of football I wish I could watch but refuse. Let the guys play like they did back in the day. Also move it past the Super Bowl and back to Hawaii so guys actually show up. Well, I mean, there is a financial incentive to show up. These guys all get paid extra money to play in this game. That's how you get them to show up. Hawaii would be nice. I had Eric Wood on with me on Friday, Thad, and, you know, the one time that he did go to the Pro Bowl, it was still in Hawaii, and he said that is a major attraction factor for the players to participate because of the hangout factor. You know, he said some guys, you know, went to the Pro Bowl. I can't remember where he said it was. Maybe it was Orlando and the weather wasn't good, or maybe it was somewhere else one year. And he basically said, what we did in Hawaii was you go to practice, you know, you do your little bit of media, and then you come back to the hotel and you hang around the pool all afternoon, you know, swim up bar, the whole thing. You know, I don't have to get into details. I think we have an idea of where it all goes when they're out in Hawaii. And that's just not on the table when you don't have an outdoor venue that, you know, where the weather's nice in January and you can, or February, and you can make it work. So while I think Hawaii might be welcomed with open arms by just about anybody involved with the Pro Bowl, player or coach, I just, to get the guys to play like they did back in the day, I think that's already dead and gone.
Couldn't agree more. You know, that the idea that that game is ever going to be a real game again is now imaginary. It's not coming back. You know, and I've heard the same stories as you about Hawaii and why that's fun. I'd like to see Hawaii versus Vegas. I think this was the first time the Pro Bowl was in Vegas. So there's certainly an attraction to Las Vegas that might make it worthwhile. You know, in terms of the idea about moving it back to after the Super Bowl, I know a lot of these guys, you know, this is their offseason, their vacation time. You know, I think it probably makes more sense to put it closer to the regular season, so you're not forcing a guy to, you know, cut into that time. I don't know if it really makes that much of a difference.
Yeah.
But I mean, the big thing that people need to digest about the Pro Bowl is that it's never again going to be anything close to a real game. It will always be, of the four sports, the game that is the most distant from the game you'd see during the regular season, simply for the injury factor. I mean, look, I don't want to see Stephon Diggs go hard against Trayvon Diggs and, you know, blow a knee. Or I don't want to see, you know, Deion Dawkins having to deal with Chandler Jones or whoever and tearing a pectoral muscle. No one cares. You know, it's just not worth it. You think about memories of all-star games. What are the things we remember most about any all-star game? Well, number one's probably Pete Rose and Ray Fosse 85 years ago.
Yeah.
And then Sean Taylor and Brian Moorman. You know, the hits and the physicalness that no one wants to see anymore. Do you remember any all-star game in any sport? The finish? Anything that happened? Who scored what number of points?
No.
I mean, I don't think people care. You know, so why get bent out of shape about what the game is like now? Just, you know, let the guys have their week off. If you want to watch it, go ahead. There's 7 or 8 other million people like you, and the NFL are happy to have all of you. And if you don't want to watch, watch golf, you know, and you know, everybody move on with their lives. You know, I guess if we want to get into, you know, better ideas, I'll go back to what I said about let's just make it super fun, make it like the Globetrotters version of football. But, you know, the idea that this is ever going to be a real game or anything even close to a real game is never going to happen. And for many good reasons, in my opinion.
Yeah. Like, I know the latest iteration of the Globetrotters, they have like a 4-point circle dots on the floor where if the guy shoots from there, it's a 4-pointer and it's like a country mile from the basket. Make the back 3 yards of the end zone, you know, a 10-point play instead of a 6-point
sure.
play, you know, something like that. Where that touchdown right there that we're watching with our MSG viewers counts as 10 points instead of 6. Like, do some of that stuff to make it a little more gimmicky. And, you know, maybe the defense is better to prevent a 10-point play from a 6-point play. I don't know. You think about it sometimes, Thad, and it's like, well, you know, the league, with as much as they push the flag football game with the youth, what have you played flag with these guys? I'd love to see linemen trying to grab flags off of running backs and stuff. I don't know.
I'll go back to what I said about, you know, the main thing that anyone wants to see with their players is not to see their guy get hurt, I think. You know, so even if you play, someone's talked about play 7-on-7, which is essentially the same thing. Either way, you still got the receivers and the D-backs in that scenario allegedly going hard. You know, or the other idea I heard was, let's make it winner take all, and the prize is like a gazillion dollars, you know, which, A, I'll go back to my argument about not wanting guys get hurt, but B, that has a little feel of Roman emperors and the gladiators, and then a little off-putting from that point of view about, let's just give them a truckload of money and make them beat them other up, beat each other up for our entertainment. You know, I have no need for that. I mean, I get 18 weeks of that plus playoffs, I'm cool. You know, I think that the best way, try and make it as fun as possible. You know, you talk about the 10-point touchdown. I love that. How about, you know, put a microphone on, like I said, Stephon Diggs. I mean, have him talk trash on, you know, as he's running a play, or even, you know, bring some fan down and say, all right, you know, try and defend Stephon Diggs. Then he runs into like 7 moves and does the thing that makes us all have our eyeballs pop out of our head during training camp, and just make it as fun as possible. You want to do the whole confetti popping out of the water bucket thing with the referee? Sure, I'm down with all of that, you know, because you can't make it a game anymore. Yeah. It's a farce. So almost lean into the farce, make it as farce funny as possible.
Yeah, I was thinking of another thing. You take the Arena League narrower field goal posts, so you put like a net behind it with, you know, those two lines down the netting. If the guy hits it dead center in the middle, you know, maybe it's 4 points instead of 3, you know, kind of do that kind of thing. You just got to – and then, you know, your final score is 90-87. You've turned it into either an arena game or an NBA game. For lack of a better term.
I get tired of reading the people who are – I hate the Pro Bowl. It's terrible. Well, of course it is. You know, what do you want it to be? So let's try and make it as fun as possible.
Yeah. We got to take a break here. Thad and I back with more, including an interesting plan by Twitter at the Super Bowl with SoFi Stadium. We'll tell you what that is when we return here on One Bills Live, presented by Kaleida Health. It's Buffalo Bills Radio. All right, welcome back to One Bills Live. Chris Brown, Thad Brown with you here on a Monday. And with the Super Bowl now 6 days away, Twitter, who has done some pretty interesting things the last couple of Super Bowls, they dropped confetti that had fans' tweets on it a couple of years ago in Miami at Super Bowl 54. And then last year they had the thank you messages for first responders, frontline workers, you know, amidst COVID. This year with SoFi Stadium, though, they're going to the roof. They're going to the roof of the stadium, which really isn't a roof. It's like a skin that's stretched with, you know, steel cables. It's almost like a floating roof of sorts. But it has LED projection capabilities up there. And so if you go to the Twitter handle at Twitter Sports, Twitter's asking you to tweet your wildest Super Bowl 56 prediction in 6 words or less. And they're basically telling fans some of the wildest, funniest, or craziest predictions will appear on the SoFi Stadium roof. And so one might ask, well, who the hell is going to see it up there? Because it's going up to the sky, not like down into the stadium. And I did not know this, Thad, but apparently the stadium is directly in the takeoff and landing path of airplanes going to LAX.
So I guess you get that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a great idea. You know, I think it's going to be super fun. People are watching MSG can see it, what it looks like. I mean, it will, you know, and I would imagine that at some point during the broadcast, you know, that will be something that will be shown or promoted. So there's a good chance that the 100 and whatever million viewers that will watch the Super Bowl might see one of your tweets if it's creative enough. And, you know, Twitter has long been the place that people come to discuss sports events. I mean, look, I'll be honest. You know, one of the fun things I like to do, you know, if I'm just chilling at home watching a game, is to fire up Twitter and see if anybody else is talking about it. It's fun to have that conversation, you know, within the game. So, you know, Twitter's kind of controlled the social media world when it comes to sports events. And this is just another reason, another way they can do it. So I love it. I was a little surprised that, you know, you pointed out that it's going to be on top of the roof and not inside the roof.
Yeah.
Now there's a story I read where they said that they'll probably put some tweets on inside the stadium anyway.
Yeah.
But my first initial reaction was someone tweets like, Stafford's going to be terrible, and having Matt Stafford look up and the roof inside having this giant picture of a tweet where it says Stafford's going to be terrible.
Yeah.
And how funny that would have been.
The screeners,
but either way, it's still a cool idea.
Yeah. The screeners are going to be critical to the success of this campaign. Here's the funny thing. So I'm like, well, how many people are actually going to see this? Like, conceivably, you know, all these tweets, what is the audience that made them feel it's worthwhile to put it on the roof? And I read in the Sports Business Journal, because of the stadium's location, the estimates are 80,000 to 100,000 people could fly over the venue on an average game day. I know LAX is a busy airport, but that is a much larger number than I would have guessed. I mean, that's more than it's going to be sitting in the stadium.
You know, and I know, you know, you and I are sports people immersed in that world, but who the heck plans a flight for the evening of Super Bowl Sunday? I mean, yeah. You can't like have a different day. I mean, what travel plans, where do you need to be that you have to be in the air between noon and midnight on Super Bowl Sunday? I mean, why would anybody ever, you know, again, yeah. You know, I always got to go back to, there's actually more people in the world or in America that don't watch Super Bowl than do, at least according to the TV ratings. But regardless, you know, I just can't imagine being on a flight then. But hey, if Sports Business Journal says it, they are really smart and do a lot of great stuff in this area of sports. It must be true.
Right. And the other thing I was thinking too was, can you picture the boardroom creative session here? Like just talking about what they want to do. Like, all right, we got this association with the Super Bowl, so that's covered. How are we gonna maximize our exposure here? And I could just totally see somebody sitting there going, well, we could put it on the roof. And then somebody said, wait a second. Hold on. Let's think about that. That might be something. Like, got to believe it was a joke first. And then they actually sat and thought about it and said, well, hold on a minute. There might be a way to use that. And here we are. I guarantee you that probably happened. Somebody cracked a joke, and then it turned up being the actual idea that they're going to put into practice on Sunday night. Now, the only thing is, so the game, I'm wondering how this is going to work, though, Thad, because now I'm thinking the game is like 3:30 kickoff Pacific time, right? Like, give or
take. Yep. Yeah, you're right.
So you still got a good 2 hours of daylight.
If not more, yeah.
So you're looking, you know, at halftime, maybe?
I'm assuming the lights are perhaps bright enough. It's an LED board. Maybe you can see it at night.
Yeah.
Or during the day, I should say. Let me, hold on. I'll look up Las Vegas sunset for you quick.
Well, L.A., yeah. So.
Oh, it's L.A., my bad.
So, I mean, I know it got dark here around 5. It's getting dark here around 5:30 so. And
5:30 tonight. So, I mean, the game is going to be in the third quarter before the sun goes down.
Yeah, so I'm wondering. So they thought about the roof, but I don't know if they thought about the daylight.
I'm going to look. I thought that board meeting, I'm going to turn it around the other way. I think it went, hey, we've got this roof that we can put signs on. What should we do with it? Let's put tweets on there. Okay, great, done. Lunch, you know, that kind of thing. That's what I kind of had in mind.
Forgot about when the sun goes down. Yeah. I'm just thinking of that now, and I don't know if they thought of it, but I don't know. Maybe the LEDs work to where they're still visible. But I mean, if it's a sunny day, I don't know if you're seeing that out of an airplane. I never thought we'd get to this point where social media is catering to people flying by 500 miles an hour on an airplane by hoping they look out the window. This isn't even jumping the shark. Like, we are in real uncharted territory here. Yes. Like, to a degree I never anticipated, but here we are.
And I'm not even interested in the football anymore. I just want to know if this is going to be visible during the first quarter.
Yeah. I want to know how this is going to work. That, now I'm intrigued. Yeah. So I'll be trying to get the lowdown on that. I'm sure it'll be covered somewhere in the 4-hour pregame show. So I'm not worried about that at all. All right, we got to take a break here, because when we come back, second hour of the show, we'll be joined by Cincinnati Bengals radio color analyst Dave Lapham, who is going to give us the update on the Bengals as I believe they're set to travel later today to head out to L.A. and get ready for the rest of Super Bowl week. Dave Lapham joining us next here on One Bills Live, presented by Kaleida Health. It's Buffalo Bills Radio.
Tasker, who has been all over the field.
Kind of unique. He was kind of a dual-role player for you. Steve.
A balloon.
Steve. A blimp. We're not even in the stratosphere of normalcy.
Evan McPherson could send him to the Super Bowl.
4 years ago, he was a senior in high school in tiny Fort Payne, Alabama. Now the Bengals' Super Bowl chances rest on his right foot. The kick is up.
Yeah.
It
yeah.
is good! Coffin nails!
Bam! 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 That is unbelievable. The Cincinnati Bengals come from behind on the road. Unbelievable, Dan.
It is no fluke. It is a fact. The Cincinnati Bengals are headed to Super Bowl 56.
All right. One very excited Dave Lapham was on the call there. The bam, bam, bam was all you. Were you making the same sounds when you were going to Super Bowl 16? I mean, you were on the field then.
No, I can't say that I was making those same sounds. Boy, that's 40 years ago. I don't know where time went. It's crazy. But we had a big celebration this year, brought a lot of players back from that Super Bowl 16 team celebrating the 40th year anniversary, and boom, they go Super Bowl 56. It's unbelievable. It really is.
Yeah. We're talking with Dave Lapham, Bengals radio color analyst, host of the In the Trenches podcast, and former Bengals lineman for about 10 seasons with them, and as I said, went to Super Bowl 16 with them. So Dave, you know, the euphoria, I have to imagine, is still through the roof in Cincinnati. I know they're doing a pep rally tonight before the team as kind of a send-off to L.A. So what would you say is the vibe, if you've had any opportunity to kind of talk to any of the players or at least be around them as they prepare to head out to L.A.?
Well, because of COVID protocols, the contact with the players isn't right, like it has been in the past, but I have had some contact with players, and comparing it to the two Super Bowl appearances in the 80s, Super Bowl 16 and Super Bowl 23 in 81, 82, 88, 89, social media. I mean, that's the difference. The community was off the hook. I mean, they were upside down on their heads, enjoy about the Bengals going to the Super Bowl. But now with social media, the interaction, the connection between players and fans is exponentially greater. You know, it's amazing. And because of that, I mean, the fan base in the entire tri-state area is going crazy, no doubt.
Dave, you know, I don't know how much, how optimistic you were at the beginning of the playoffs that Cincinnati could get this far. I think we all thought it was possible. Joe Burrow's, you know, showing he can be that type of quarterback. But when you look back at the three games, is there one thing or maybe one trend or change or something you didn't expect that you look back on and after having this week to kind of digest it and said, you know, that was the thing we didn't expect, or that was the thing that changed in the postseason that allowed Cincinnati to make it all the way to the Super Bowl?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is turnovers. You know, they have six interceptions by six different players in three football games. They have seven takeaways in three football games, and they've only turned it over once. So, you know, they're plus six, and that wasn't a trend. They were just even on the season. It was an even Steven scenario. So for them to be hot in the takeaway department at the right time, I think is a big key in their success. And overall, I think the defense is the story. You know, after watching these guys, you know, perform in the playoffs, defense does win you championships. I mean, the first two games when they played the Raiders and the Titans, they held those two teams combined to 35 points, 17 and a half points per. That's going to win you games in the playoffs, you know. And then against Kansas City, hot knife through butter, first three drives, touchdowns, fourth drive, make a big play with 5 seconds to go in the half, second and one at the 1 yard line, or it would have been 28-3. They would have scored every possession. Then in the second half, 3 points. 50 yards passing by Mahomes. He'll shut out. No catches, no yard. Unbelievable. They made a lot of defensive changes, rush 3, drop 8, maybe rush 4 max, drop 7. Mahomes was – he didn't know what he was looking at. He was holding the football. They pressured him. I mean, it was an amazing juxtaposition. It was a tale of two halves, you know. And they beat the Chiefs twice in the month of January. They beat them in the regular season to clinch the division. They held them to 3 points in the second half. They beat them in the championship game, held them to 3 points in the second half. 6 points on 10 drives in the second half of those two football games against Mahomes and the Chiefs. That's crazy. Defense is a story.
Yeah, it's crazy to think about that, because Bills fans will remember in the 2020 season, the Week 5 matchup between these two teams, which was played here in Buffalo. Leslie Frazier, the defensive coordinator for the Bills, took a very similar approach in that game that the Bengals did in the second half in the AFC title game, daring the Chiefs to run the football. Now, the difference was the Chiefs did run the football in that game, and for some reason, they really didn't do a whole lot of that in the AFC title game. They kept putting it in Mahomes' hands to throw it, you know, with eight men dropping into coverage, and it stunned me with the lead that they didn't turn to the run game more in the second half of that football game. How surprised were you?
Very, very surprised. You know, I thought that, you know, you had Joe Burrow outplaying Mahomes, basically. And more importantly, you had Zach Taylor out coaching Andy Reid. You know, I mean, seriously, when you look at the head coaches and they're not just the head coaches, every coach is involved in making adjustments or not making adjustments that affect the outcome of a football game. But the Bengals made adjustments and the Chiefs made no adjustments to the adjustments. And it was stunning because that staff, you know, has got a lot of, I mean, Spagnuolo just, you know, he did his thing with the Bengals offense. Not really. I thought he handled his side of it, but man, Andy Reid and Eric Bieniemy, they made no adjustments to what the Bengals were doing in the second half, which absolutely flabbergasted me. And, you know, I thought we were going to Buffalo. I mean, Buffalo, number one in the league, yards allowed, points allowed, passing yards. You know, I mean, that defensive football team was outstanding. And, you know, when they drove in 13 seconds, you know, how much time was used up in overtime when McPherson hit that field goal?
13 seconds. Yeah.
How about that? 13 seconds in, he kicks the field goal. So, I mean, 13 was the lucky and unlucky number, I guess, for both franchises in the playoffs.
Yeah.
Dave, I want to talk a little more about Zach Taylor and the job he's done this year. I saw a stat today that the Bengals were number one in the league in third quarter point differential. Now, I know that because the Bengals plus 155 in the third quarter in the Super Bowl is looking very attractive to me. But it also, I think, indicates a team that's, you know, having a realization or an ability to adjust at halftime and come out and figure things out in the third quarter. You know, taking that stat maybe as a particular, but just the general job Taylor's done, because before this year, 2 wins, 4 wins, he hasn't coached in a big game, and now all of a sudden he's winning a bunch of them.
6-25-1 in those first two seasons. 2-14 in the first year, and it was a good year to go 2-14 in hindsight and retrospect, because you got Joe Burrow, and that's the he's the franchise. I mean, he's the straw that stirs the drink. There is no doubt about it. And then 4-11-1, and you get Ja'Marr Chase with the fifth pick in the draft. So it worked out. They get a couple of Bayou Bengals and become Cincinnati Bengals, and the rest is history. But it's incredible. The Bengals, the number of times they scored in the final 2 minutes of the first half, then followed up with scoring on their first possession in the third quarter, was unbelievable. I mean, they're in the top five in the NFL in both categories. So they would always finish strong, go in with some momentum, make some adjustments, come out even stronger in the second half. And they did that in a bunch of football games during the course of the season. And I think, you know, you got to give everybody credit. I mean, this football team, they built the defense through free agency. They got 7 new starters through free agency. They spent $125 million 2 years in a row on their defense and free agency. And they went to teams, you know, that had winning traditions, Dallas, New Orleans Saints, Pittsburgh Steelers. They're getting the free agents from those franchises that those players had an understanding of what it took. And then they built the offense through the draft. And we talked about, you know, Burrow, Ja'Marr Chase. T. Higgins was an early second-round pick. He was the first pick of the second round. It's like a late first-round pick. So, you know, they put their bat on the ball. They had the first pick in every round, the fifth pick in every round, in back-to-back drafts. You're going to usually put your bat in the ball, and they did.
And then, Dave, I don't have the numbers in front of me. I know from a statistical standpoint, rushing yards per game was not exactly super productive for this team during the course of the season. I mean, they ranked 23rd in rushing. That didn't keep Taylor from calling the run, though. The one that stood out to me in the Chiefs game was, I think they ran all 17 times on first and 10 in that football game, even though they were down on the scoreboard, weren't tremendously successful. My question to you is, knowing Zach Taylor as well as you do, has that been a byproduct of his approach all season long, or is it in response maybe a little bit to back the defense off a little bit, knowing their pass protection can be suspect?
Yeah, I think it's a combination. And I think coming off of that Tennessee game where they got sacked 9 times, actually was 11. One sack was negated by penalty. One sack was negated by timeout. But he got hit and taken on the ground 11 times. So they really, against the Chiefs, they wanted to have a modicum of some sort of successful running game, you know, to make the Chiefs back off a little bit and respect the run some in the pass rush. And they're going to have to do that in the championship game, yeah, too, in the Super Bowl against the Rams. There's no doubt. But, you know, Joe Mixon is talented, obviously, and they can use him out of the backfield. And they screen to him. They check it down to him. It's like an extension of their running game, you know. And Samaje Perine busted a screen for a 41-yard touchdown. So they got the ball out of the adjustment they made was to run it, particularly in the early downs. They get the ball out of Joe Burrow's hands real quickly, 2.5 seconds or less. You know, the screen game draws a little bit of running game play action, pass some, instead of just, you know, shotgun or drop back to pass where they can tee off. And they have to at least respect the run some. But in order to have your play action pass be effective, you have to have some kind of, you know, success in your running game, right, or they won't even, they'll totally disregard it, you know.
I mean, kind of, you know, dovetailing off that question, you know, all the concerns that Cincinnati had in the first three playoff games, you know, Max Crosby was big for the Raiders, the 9 sacks of the Titans. Chris Jones spent half that game with Joe Burrow in his pocket, basically. You know, none of those teams had Aaron Donald and Von Miller, you know. So is the need to be successful in all of that, you know, the number one concern going into this game, and being able to deal with the fact that you've got two of the NFL's all-time best pass rushers going up against an offensive line that's been really not good at, you know, protecting the quarterback?
Bingo. I think that's the biggest key to the game. You know, I think games are won and lost in the trenches, you know, I mean, at every level. And you got a team that gave up 55 sacks. The Bengals gave up 55 amongst the league leaders. I think it was 30th. You have a team that accumulated 50, tied for third most in the NFL. The Rams, I mean, like you said, Von Miller, no active player has more sacks than Von Miller. He's number one. So, you know, he was MVP of Super Bowl 50. He's got skins on the wall. Aaron Donald, I think, is the best player in the NFL, maybe. Never mind just at his position. 6'1", over 280, runs sub 4.7. That's a freak. That's a Martian. It's not a human being, you know. And then, you know, let's remember they got Floyd, too. This dude's got 9.5 sacks. Yeah. They got three guys that have 9.5 sacks or more. So, yeah, that's going to be a big, big deal. You know, the Bengals have pressured the quarterback real well this year. And the Rams, they protect their quarterback pretty well. So I think protection pressure on both sides of it are going to be a big, big factor in this football game. You know, I mean, like I said, the Rams have 50 sacks. That's third most in the NFL. They have 19 interceptions, tied for third most. And that goes hand in hand, you know, because you got pressure and the quarterback's throwing it before he wants to or whatever. And they only allowed 17 touchdown passes, second fewest to Buffalo, who only allowed 12. And that's 2 years in a row the Rams have only given up 17 touchdown passes in the regular season. That's outstanding. So it's all based on the pressure that defensive line, you know, puts on the opposing quarterback, making them uncomfortable.
Talking with Dave Lapham, Bengals radio color analyst, headed out to the Super Bowl in L.A. later this week. And, Dave, you know, we hear and we listen to Coach McDermott here in Buffalo talk about the culture that he worked so hard to build. And, you know, we're seeing this team reap the benefits of that. He's not afraid to use the word love, and these guys do a lot of loving on each other. It's a tight, tight group. And when the going gets tough, it has paid dividends for this football team. There's no question about it. I'm curious to know how Zach Taylor has built, you know, the culture there in his 3 seasons as head coach.
You've hit on a huge factor in this, about this football team. there's no jerk factor in the locker room. You know, I mean, it's a great place to be. These guys really respect each other, love each other. Like you said, I mean, they want to be around each other, not just at the facility or at practice or in the locker room, whatever. They go to dinner with each other. Position groups will go to dinner every week, you know, gather up, and they'll have meetings on their own. The defensive backs come in and meet before anybody else is in the building. And as a group, you know, are trying to digest even more information. So this football team is very, very tight, very close. And when they put it together, one of the things that they really graded heavily was what kind of a person and leader is this player. They signed and drafted a lot of captains of high school teams, of college teams. You know, they signed high-quality, high-fiber guys, you know. So I think it's paying off. I really do. I think – and to me, it's shown up in games. They've had to come from behind on a lot of football games. I mean, in the AFC Championship game, they're down 21-3. Against the Chiefs at Paul Brown Stadium on January 2nd, they're down 14-0, 21-7, 28-14. Win the game both times. So that character, I think, shows itself in resiliency, you know, never say die, not going to give up on this. We're going to figure this out. We're going to come back and win this football game. And a lot of teams, you know, don't have that. And I think this football team has it in spades.
Dave, you know, we talked about that you were in Super Bowl 16 with the Bengals when they took on the 49ers. How much different is the week and the hoopla and the festivity in the Super Bowl? I'm assuming you've been to one or two since. And how much of a factor is that going to be for a Bengals team that's in general relatively new to the whole stage?
Yeah, I think that this one's going to be interesting in that regard. And by the way, yeah, Super Bowl 16, I mean, we had one media day. You know, there was no Radio Row. There was none of that kind of stuff. I mean, I roomed with Kenny Anderson. We found this pizza place that had picnic tables, and maybe we get a pizza and a couple of, you know, pitchers of beer with guys at night. It was great. You know, everybody left us alone. It was awesome. But you know, it's a lot different now. I mean, it's a big show now. I think the pregame programming started 2 days ago. You know, it's like the build up for a game is just unbelievable. But you know, when you look at it compared to what they have going on now, it's night and day. And the thing that for the second year in a row, the home team a team is playing at their home stadium,
right?
You know, in Tampa Bay, first time last year, and they won it. LA Rams doing it this year. That's huge. I mean, the guys are staying in their homes. They're sleeping in their own bed. They're going to the same hotel they go to it for every home game. You know, I mean, it's all the stuff that you have to do in terms of tickets and taking care of your family and friends, flights, hotel rooms. These guys don't have to worry about any of that stuff. That's a factor. I think that's a big deal. I don't think the crowd noise is going to be as bad as the Bengals have faced on the road in the last couple of playoff games. I mean, Kansas City, Arrowhead, you can't even hear yourself think. This is a corporate event. The NFL pays back their advertisers, and it's a corporate event. They get all the tickets. So I don't think it's going to be crazy that way. But leading up to the Super Bowl and all the things that you have to, you know, worry about and burn energy over, you know, it's like the Rams have no concern in that regard, and the Bengals got a ton, man. I think it's a factor.
Yeah. Well, enjoy yourself out there, Dave, and we'll probably – I don't know if everybody's rooting for the Bengals. The Bills fans are a little jealous after watching them kind of zoom right through in their first appearance in the playoffs in a while, right to the big game. Bills fans are still smarting a little bit, as you might imagine, but enjoy it out there, and we'll be watching for sure.
Yeah, I'll tell you, one thing that I think this team understands is – there's no guarantee you're going back.
Yeah.
So take advantage of the opportunity, you know, enjoy it, play loose, you know, have fun, all those things, because man, it's hard to get there, man. Really hard.
Yeah. Thanks again, Dave. We appreciate it. That's
all right, guys.
Bengals radio color analyst Dave Lapham joining us here on One Bills Live. We'll be back with more when we return. We'll see you in a second. All right, welcome back to One Bills Live. Chris Brown, Thad Brown with you. And while we were talking to Dave Lapham from the Bengals Radio Network about the Super Bowl, there was some Bills news that came down, a transaction, as defensive tackle Ili Anku was signed to a reserve futures contract. And, you know, I got to say, that he played in six games down the stretch, and he was kind of a space-eating presence in there. I think he offered them more than maybe even they anticipated.
I agree. I think he played pretty well, considering, you know, you kind of felt like a practice squad body that was being called up because, Justin Zimmer had been gone for the year. Star Lotulelei was in and out of the lineup late. I think he was pretty solid. I think this is a guy that could be in a position to compete for a roster spot next year. I mean, keep in mind, you know, the Bills need four inside guys the way they play their D-line. They're going to rotate them, you know, so Harrison Phillips is good. Matt Oliver is good, obviously. After that, you know, I think Star is probably back and fine, but Ankow is going to have a good shot to be one of those, you know, four guys next season.
Yeah, so not just your, you know, under-the-radar reserve future signing.
Correct.
I think he's firmly on the radar, and I think he will compete, as you said. I think you're looking for a stand-your-ground kind of player to just stand in there and grind, hopefully gobble up two people to let your three technique next to him kind of eat. And I think he showed, at least on a rotational basis, an ability to be effective in that kind of a role for them. And even when the ball came his way, he made some plays in the run front. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's a guy that's going to have at least a look at it, and it'll be on him to kind of prove he deserves to be one of those top four. And I think worst-case scenario, you know, he's back on the practice squad again, and you could do a lot worse than him for a practice squad call-up during the year. We'll have to see if they keep those practice squad rules. Don't you think, based on the roster flexibility that the expanded practice squad and practice squad call-up rules gave the coaches and the front office, they're going to be pounding the table to continue those, whether we're in a much better place with COVID or not come the fall?
Well, of course. I mean, you get more control over more players, expanded practice squad, and the opportunity to use more guys without having to expose them to waivers immediately after being called up to the active roster. So, you know, from a league and team point of view, or maybe mostly from a team point of view, I'm sure they love those rules. You know, the question is, does the Players Association like the idea that teams can use guys, especially young guys trying to make a name for themselves, as still practice squad players, but also play them on game day as a part of the active roster without having to then sign them and pay them like active roster players? I think in the long run, it probably works out better for the league as a whole. Obviously the teams love it. I think it's fine for the players because I think it gives teams more flexibility to put these guys into game situations and get them looks that way. You know, maybe, you know, you force them into deciding whether or not you want to keep that guy on your active roster. So I think there's a good chance that maybe not 100% of the expanded and freewheeling practice squad rules remain, but I think it's going to look a whole lot different than it was in 2019 in terms of what you can do and who you can keep and who you can, you know, elevate up and down.
Yeah. I mean, I think from a Players Association perspective, it's positive because it's more jobs for more of your rank and file members. It's not, you know, 53 man roster money, but it's still an opportunity nonetheless to be in the NFL environment, develop against legitimate NFL talent, you know, in the practice setting I'm talking about mainly. And if I remember right, the practice squad is supposed to go up to 14 players this year anyway in the new CBA. It had been 12, and then it was expanded to 16 under the COVID rules. But I think in 2022, if I remember right, it's supposed to go up to 14 automatically anyway. So what the heck's two more players?
Right. Yeah, I think you're right. And there were expanded rules. There was also the rule about having, you know, practice squad guys. There was the old rule about if you had two accrued NFL seasons, you're no longer eligible for the practice squad. Now you're going to be able to have a couple spots that are basically you could have a guy that could make a career out of being a practice squad player now. And those things were all, you know, COVID separate. So, yeah, those were happening, you know, to begin with. And, you know, I'll go back to the original point. I think there are some concerns from the Players Association point of view about a team being able to prevent a guy from being on an active roster. But separate of those, the rest of this seems to be really good for the team, at least moderately good, like you said, for the rank and file player. So why not keep doing it?
Yeah, now that you're saying that, now you're making me think that if there's one bone to pick that the Players Association will have, it'll be that four-player protected rule on the practice squad. They'll probably push back on that, knowing it could potentially cost four players every week from getting on an active roster somewhere else. So that might be one of the tweaks going forward, if there are any. Or who knows, maybe in some strange world we'll be free and rid of COVID, at least as we know it, and we can have a normal NFL season. That would be nice, for sure. So cross your fingers and toes on that. We did want to get back to the tweet sheet with your thoughts on the best way to make the NFL Pro Bowl more interesting. We didn't necessarily say better, just interesting. So Jack says, give the whole NFL a bye week the first or second week of December. Move the game to then in season and give a monetary incentive to the winning team. That is never going to fly. That is never going to fly. They're never going to expose players.
You want to risk a playoff berth because a guy got hurt in a Pro Bowl? I mean, you want to see – you think a lot of guys opted out of this Pro Bowl? I mean, that Pro Bowl would be played – it might as well be the practice squad Pro Bowl because that would be the only people who would show up for the game.
Yeah, right. Dinah says, instead of a game, just have the skills competition for all players. I will say that draws the interest of fans. We saw, I mean, the NHL's doing it. They were in the same place. They were in Vegas last weekend, obviously. And I think people tune in for that because it's a different way to assess the true ability, you know, of these highly talented professional athletes. And I told you, I'm signing up for dodgeball. I mean, I'll do it.
I'm with you. I think it's a pretty viable alternative. You know, I wonder if the NFL is worried about, if you take away the game and you do this, can you do this for 3 hours so that you sustain amount of commercial freight you're already selling, you know, A, and B, you know, would it be when you don't have a game anymore, you know, are people less likely to watch? Remember, you know what? There was an over-under yesterday. There was a line. I think the AFC was the favorite or something. So you take away those things, you know, you're going to reduce some interest in it. But you know, this idea, you know, works fine for me. I think you're still going to, like you said, showcase what these guys can do. You're going to do it in an environment where no one's going to probably get seriously injured. I think guys are going to have fun. I think it will draw eyeballs. So I'd be open to this one.
Yeah. Now you got me thinking about, about odds on who's the last man standing in dodgeball. That's dodgeball. Coming.
That'd be great.
That's coming.
Oh, 100% I'd bet on that. That'd be so much fun.
Now I'm picturing the war chest getting rolled out at the end of Dodgeball, the movie. Oh, my God. Pirates. I'm thinking everything now. This is getting out of control.
As long as Vince Vaughn and can play, that's fine with me.
Yeah. Kimberly says, just do away with it. It can't be fixed. Well, that's a little negative Nancy there. Running Man says, you would have to find a way to have a Pro Bowl that doesn't actually include a football game. Professional football is not a pickup sport where you can randomly throw a bunch of people together to risk injury for a meaningless exhibition. That's why I suggested flag football, but Thad did kind of point out you'd still have people kind of going hard, you know, to catch people, to avoid people, and so the risk of injury is always there. So I don't know that that's necessarily a solution either. Jen says, with the play style of yesterday's game, you may as well go with no pads, no helmets, and two-hand touch, but to make it more interesting, extra points and extra money to charities for every touchdown made on a trick play. Now, that's going down the path that might have some merit here.
Sure. More trick plays should have been a rule for the Pro Bowl a long time ago. In fact, like every play should be a trick play.
Yeah.
I mean, if the quarterback throws a pass, that's a bad play. Someone not named a quarterback should be throwing every pass in the game or something along those lines. I mean, like I said, lean into the fun part of this. It's no longer Running Man says you need to have a Pro Bowl doesn't actually include a football game. We already have that. That's what we've been doing for the last few years. Yeah. This is not a football game. So any fun idea is open and welcome. I really like your idea about 10-point touchdowns for certain point in the end zone or plays that are completed at certain points in the end zone. Any of those things are fine with me.
Yeah. Now I'm thinking we should also have, we should reinstitute punting, but only offensive or defensive linemen can field punts. That should be.
I like that.
That should be another one that is put in the Pro Bowl. That is entertainment value. If you've never seen it before, it is entertainment value on another level.
Oh, yes. And eligible receivers, everybody's eligible. All 11 guys are good. Every play, I'm fine with that. I mean, we already had Stephon Diggs playing D-back yesterday. So I mean, Deion Dawkins at tight end next year, Myles Garrett, you know, running, sweeps out of the backfield. All these things are fair game. I mean, the punters didn't do anything yesterday, right? Put them on the field for something, whatever we want to do. The more fun, the more unique, the more different, probably the better off we're going to be with this thing.
Yeah. Rick says, make the two worst teams play in a game. Winning team gets the number one pick. Now, while this sounds like blood sport to fans, I got to think, I'm thinking about, you know, the Jaguars and who's got the number two pick this year. So it's the Jags and was somebody worse?
Detroit, I think.
Detroit, yeah. So the Jags and the Lions, while fans probably view the, oh, they're going to be at each other's throats to get the number one pick. Look at the incentive. And I'm thinking, if I'm one of the players on the Jaguars, you know, especially if, like, I mean, they're not going to draft a quarterback over after taking Trevor Lawrence last year. But if you have, like, a 32-year-old quarterback on the worst football team in the league and the number one pick is, like, some surefire quarterback prospect, is that guy really working hard to win that game? I don't know that he is.
No.
Because you're drafting his replacement.
I mean, you might set an NFL record for interceptions and a half. You know, I mean, it would get messy in a hurry for that reason. And there's just not – I don't think there's enough incentive in the world for – you'd have to make it the winning team gets the number one pick and, you know, gets to own Massachusetts, something like that. I mean, that'd be about the only thing you'd do to properly incentivize that kind of game.
Yeah. Bob Kraft probably thinks he does already.
Yes.
But that's neither here nor there. Christopher on the tweet sheet says, half game between AFC East, AFC West, comma, AFC North, AFC South, et cetera, et cetera. Winners of each face off until one AFC and one NFC division is left, then play for a winner. So are we talking like, so you play half a game between, so I basically the four divisions in the AFC each have to play half the game, like an all-star team from each division. Is that what he's saying?
This is kind of like the hockey idea where they kind of take an all-star team of divisions and they have a little round robin and play it that way. So I would imagine you play 15 minutes, AFC East versus West, winners, you move on, you do the whole thing. I mean, it has some interest because you might have some in some division pride, I guess. But you'd also have like three quarters of your Pro Bowl Patrick Mahomes is on the sideline because the AFC West is not playing. Or if he gets eliminated early, you know, and you're down to Kirk Cousins against Mac Jones, I mean, you know, that's not ideal television viewing. So I think it works for hockey because the game moves a little faster from, you know, you can play short games, I think, easier. They also, I'm pretty sure, do it without a full roster on the ice. Maybe they play 3-on-3 or 4-on-4 or something. So, again, there's no bad idea with this. Because the bad idea is what we all saw yesterday. So I just don't think you get enough interest and functionality out of this idea to make it work.
Yeah, and I'm kind of wondering, too, because some other people were tweeting in about incentivizing the outcome of the Pro Bowl. You know, like Major League Baseball does that, you know, with their all-star game. What is it? The home team for the World Series. So
they don't do that anymore though. They did that about 5 years ago, but yeah.
Yeah, they phased that out. And I don't know how you would apply that to the Super Bowl, which is technically a neutral site game anyway. The only thing I'm thinking of is you give the winning conference the choice at the start of the game. In other words, eliminate the coin toss. They get the choice because, you know, the Rams get the choice because the NFC won the Pro Bowl. But how hard is all the NFC players not playing in the Super Bowl going to work for the Rams? Like, I don't know if that even works.
Well, you do it for the next year. So they'd be playing this year for Super Bowl 57. You could also, if you wanted to do that, you could do, you know, we do have 17 game schedule right now. You could say the winning conference gets to have the extra game at home the next year.
I know that
the NFL wanted to do the rotating thing with that, but you could say, okay, all you guys are playing in this game. You know, if you win, y'all get to have an extra game at home next year. You know, that might be a thing.
Yeah. Or you get to play and not play in London.
now that would be blood sport, Brownie. Now you got an idea.
I like that idea. So
you think so? Okay.
Yeah. I mean, eventually it might get to a place where they say, this is not fair. This should be alternating. That's what the original rule intended. So why are you incentivizing that? But that would get player. I think that would get players motivated. I mean, you think about.
I'd say it would get owners motivated, you know, able to have that extra gate at home every year.
Yeah. So it's an incentive for owners because, you're taking 60% of the gate instead of 40%. So there's that. And, you know, all your advertisers and sponsors are benefiting as well. So, yeah, that would be high stakes stuff. I just wonder, while players, I know a lot of Bills players would be all about getting an extra home game because they know what the atmosphere is like here and they know that's beneficial to them. I just wonder if that's universal across the conference.
What Dave Lapham just pointed out with the Rams this week, sleeping in their own bed. I mean, even if you don't have the same, fan benefit from being home, you don't have to be on a plane for one extra week out of the year. So, and the other thing too about it, the one thing I thought of as you were talking is that, a bunch of these guys might be on different teams next year. Well, most of them probably won't be because these are the good players, the ones that have the long-term contracts and will be coming back. So a lot of these guys, 80, 90% of them are legitimately playing to be home for an extra game the next year.
Yeah, we do have to step aside here, but we'll be bringing you some less than surprising news out of the Houston Texans camp as they've finally settled on a head coach. We'll find out who that is. And with this being Thad's last appearance this week, we'll get his thoughts on a Super Bowl prediction. That's coming up next here on One Bills Live, presented by Collider Health. It's Buffalo Bills Radio. All right, welcome back. To no one's surprise, it looks as though Lovie Smith is going to be the next head coach of the Houston Texans, so the third franchise he will lead as head coach, having previously coached the Bears and the Bucks. Thad, it is time for your Super Bowl prediction, and I am not looking for anything on the money line or the spread. I just want an outright winner from you. So let us have it. What do you got for us?
I really think the Rams should win this game. We talked about it with Dave Lapham. The Bengals have all kinds of protection issues. Now they have to deal with Aaron Donald and Von Miller and Floyd and all the guys that they have, on that Rams front four. The Rams are the team with maybe probably the better skill talent. I think the Bengals have a great group of receivers, but, Cooper Kupp had an incredible year at receiver. So they should win the game. But the Chiefs should have probably won their game, and I think the Titans probably should have won their game as well against the Bengals. And Cincinnati found a way in both of those. I think the Bengals' defense is underrated. I know they were terrible earlier in the year. But it's not just deflected interceptions. They've got Trey Hendrickson, he was a double-digit sack guy as an edge rusher this year. Bates, the safety, is a high-level, guy at the back at the third level of the Cincinnati defense. So I'm going to ride the magic. I think they continue to get it done, find a way. I go Bengals 24-23. I do like the under. Best. I wouldn't bet Cincinnati. I probably will bet the under. I think it remains a pretty low scoring game. And I think it'll be, the last six playoff games were five of them were decided in the last play. And the other one went to the last minute. I think we make it 7 of 7 for the great playoff finish for the NFL.
Yeah. I'll sign up for a tight game. I'm always a fan of those. Cause I lived through a lot of blowouts as I know you did in the '80s with teams like, the Denver Broncos, the old Elway teams getting blown out in those Super Bowls, the Patriots against the 85 Bears. There were a lot of bad ones. I'll take a tight game any day of the week. Last thing, a good suggestion laid on the tweet sheet from Good Burr. Turn it into a Young Stars game. AFC versus NFC first and second year players only. They'll be more likely to play harder and help shine a light on the young talent in the league. The NBA does that with a Young Stars game, I think, preceding the actual All-Star game. Anniversary to mention, 29 years ago today, Steve Tasker was named MVP of the Pro Bowl. How about that? So Steve will be joining us tomorrow. But Thad, thanks very much for helping us out, not only today, but last Thursday as well. We appreciate it. We will catch up with you later in the offseason. Good on you for helping us out, man. Appreciate it.
Love me on, guys. Thanks again.
All right. We will be back on Tuesday. Steve Tasker will be alongside me. We will see you at 1 p.m.